If you enjoy this podcast, please like us on Facebook and follow us on Instagram and visit our website at lifebetweenthevines.com.
It isn't just about the grapes. It isn't just about the land. If you don't have good people that you're working with, you don't have any of that.
We're better now today with more friendly competition. The wine community bands together when anything happens in our universe, agriculturally, fires, whatever. We're there for each other. And I feel the farming community needs each other, and we need to compete with each other in a positive fashion. I think that's been good for building up Napa Valley.
Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle.
And welcome to podcast number 513. This week we feature Connor McMahon, owner and winemaker at Full Draw Vineyard in Paso Robles. The Paso Robles area of California is an incredibly diverse grape-growing segment of wine country. You can find just about any wine you'd like to drink, including Rhone varietals. Full Draw Vineyard is located in the Templeton Gap AVA and is owned by Connor McMahon. Several wineries can be found surrounding Full Draw, making it a fun place to visit. We caught up with Connor just after harvest in October and got a brief glimpse into growing a winery while growing a family. You can hear Connor on our Vino Lingo segment, defining the term punchdown. Well, this is the first time live in Paso Robles, and I'm just totally thrilled to be here because it's incredible wine country. And today I am here with Connor McMahon, and Connor is the owner and winemaker at Full Draw Vineyard.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here and happy to be a part of this video blog. We're really excited.
Thanks. I appreciate that. Well, it's just one of those things that never gets old when you say it, but beautiful area, wonderfully hilly. And this is Templeton Gap referred to. Is that an AVA or no?
Templeton Gap is an AVA. We are technically in the Willow Creek District AVA. These AVAs were set aside by the Paso Robles Wine Alliance a handful of years ago. Templeton Gap, I mean, is a great area. The coastal influence that we get is fantastic. So during the day it can be 105, and then at night it cools down to 65. So that huge diurnal shift really helps de-stress the vines at night, and it's great for winemaking.
How far from the coast are we here?
We're only about 15 miles as the crow flies. It might take 30 minutes to get there, but when it's hot over here, it's cool over there. So we'll jump over there for a taco in the middle of the summer and enjoy the cool weather.
Nice. Yeah, and it's definitely not a straight line getting to the coast.
That's no, right. not at all.
The nature of California. Again, an area I haven't been to personally, though I've interviewed plenty of winemakers from here, and I feel a little bit embarrassed about that because it's such an important part of California. And what's great is that Paso Robles wines are very, very good, and overall the pricing is more than reasonable.
I think that one of the great things that Paso has done is kind of set itself aside from other regions where we still are local owner, winemaker, wineries, really starting to get out in the national market. But like you said, good price points. And the great thing about Paso, there's so many different varieties that are grown here. Take Full Draw, for example. We actually have 8 different varieties grown on the property. And so it's just very diverse in winemaking styles, price points, and it's just a fun area to be a part of.
So let's talk about those very specifically. I see you do Grenache, and I see you do Syrah, and what else are you making here?
We really focus on Rhone varieties, although we do have some varieties planted from outside of that category. We have predominantly Syrah, Grenache, and Mourvedre planted here, but we also have varieties such as Cabernet, Sauvignon, and Tempranillo planted here as well.
I didn't know you were doing Cabernet. I didn't see that on your list, but just kind of go into Mourvedre for a second here. Are you bottling that by itself or using it strictly as a blend?
So Mourvedre, specifically for me, it only gets bottled in vintages where we deem exceptional, and we rely heavily on that as a blending wine in 2 of our wines, which are Honey Bunny and Chopping Block, and it's really hard to take away your best Mourvedre to make its own bottling when those take so much and really need that wine in the blend.
When's the last time you did a Mourvedre?
2018 was the last time. Oh. I mean, really, we're only on the 2020 release right now, so it's been two vintages.
Sure.
21, we tried to do it, but realized that we needed all of the Mourvèdre for our other blends. So we've actually withheld a little bit from clients that we sell fruit to be able to produce that wine again.
It's just such an incredible grape, and just one of those you go nuts over, for me anyway.
Oh, absolutely. And same here in-house. Myself and the team, we love that wine so much, but every time we make its own blend and come up with something cool, we realize that we've taken too much away from Chopping Block and Honey Bunny, and we just kind of say, well, in the future we'll be able to do it.
You're bringing up a couple of interesting names here of these specific wines, and I'm going to come back to those in a
sure.
bit. But I want to talk about the name Full Draw. I'm always fascinated by winery names. Where did Full Draw come from?
So I actually grew up in a small town in southeast Iowa called Fairfield. Went to Iowa State University. But one of the things that is big in Iowa is archery. So I was actually shooting archery as a kid. And when we fast forward a couple years later to 2012, when I'd purchased the property, we were trying to figure out a way to keep something close to my childhood and my past. And so Full Draw was something that I came up with. And that's a term in the archery side of the world, that when you have your bow pulled all the way back, you're a full draw. And so it was something I'm very family oriented and personal person. So that was something that would be important to me to keep incorporated.
The whole idea makes me quiver.
Oh, God.
That's twice in 2 days. Twice. I've got to use that.
Yeah, that's a good one.
I'm so sorry.
No, it's all good.
Okay. It's interesting because these influences on winemakers, your past, your present, and what you want to do is such a big deal when it comes to them. But Honey Bunny, I'm a little curious about that.
Yeah, so we actually have a different name and a different piece of artwork for each of our labels. We found that in Paso, we're actually able to kind of be a little more creative with our labels than other regions. So in 2016, when my wife and I were making our first vintage, we said, okay, now that all the wine's in barrel, we're happy with it, what are we going to do with our labels? And we were in a small town in Colorado walking through and saw a painting very similar to Honey Bunny, which is a P-40 Curtiss, which was a fighter plane from the 1940s in World War II. Both my grandfathers having served in World War II, that painting had a lot of emotions come flooding back to me because of that. And so we talked to the gallery owner and tried to get something worked out, but couldn't make it happen. But we were fortunate enough to get the artist's name. And so Michael Bryan out of Huntington Beach, I had a great conversation with him on the phone. And one thing that we discussed was actually having him figure out a way to get his artwork on our label. But he wanted to taste the wine first. And I said, well, why would you want to do that? And he said, I'm not going to let you put my beautiful artwork on a crummy wine. And I'm putting it very politely, but he had some colorful words to say, which were fantastic. But we had lunch with him and had a great time. And he actually ended up commissioning the piece of artwork, which is hanging downstairs, for my wife and I. So the name Honey Bunny came from my grandmother, my grandma Rose. I called her and said, hey, what was a cute blonde like you nickname back then? She said, Honey Bunny. So that's why we named the plane and the wine.
Oh, that's very cool. What a great history to have behind a name like
exactly.
that.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I'd be remiss, of course, if I didn't talk about where you came from. Obviously, you came from Iowa, which is really cool. My dad was from Iowa originally. And, you know, there's a bit of a stretch between Iowa and the wine industry. So, as I always like to say, was there a moment? Were you raised in a family that liked wine? How did it come to you?
Really, it was. That's how it started. It was a family that liked wine. We're Irish Catholic, so we drink and reproduce usually in that order. So there's a lot of us. But as a kid, I just remember having huge family gatherings. I was blessed enough to have a small town, small community. But my grandparents from my dad's side of the family, two of his brothers, and we all had cousins our age, similar age range. And so every family gathering was, I don't want to call it a party, but there was always empty wine bottles on the counter and in the recycling bin the next morning. But that's really how I got into it. I remember having a glass of wine with my dad and one other gentleman, and he said, hey, come try this. So I had a sip of it and I was just blown away. I might have been 19 at the time. started asking a ton of questions, and I said, I get why you guys drink this stuff now. And he goes, why else would we drink it? And I said, well, for the after effect? He goes, well, we're not in high school. We're not drinking Busch Light and Jack Daniels. I said, that makes sense. But it actually happened to be a very prominent, famous wine, which is Chateau de Beaucastel from 1989. And ever since I had a sip of that wine, I was just hungry for information, and that's kind of how it started.
It's fascinating how wine gets into you like that, isn't it? It's not just the idea of the alcohol getting into your blood.
Right.
It's this bit of history in a bottle.
Yes. It's somewhere that you can buy a six-pack of wine, you have one of those bottles, and you're sharing it with your spouse or a friend, and then the next time you open that bottle a couple of years later, you say, that one time I had this great experience. And so, I mean, that's one of the things I really do love about wine, is it connects you in a moment of time, but also with friends, family, and close people that you hold dear to you.
Yeah, it's a great way of putting it, because we've all had that experience as wine lovers, and you don't forget those moments, do you?
Correct.
Yeah.
No, it's fantastic.
Yeah. And as a matter of fact, we got to meet your wife on the way in, which
oh,
was really nice.
Awesome.
And also her co-pilot in the car.
Yeah, Winston was with her today, so we're blessed with two very crazy young kids. We have a daughter, Maeve, who's at school today, and she's four, but I think the term spitfire or firecracker is an understatement. And then you saw Winston, who's a year and a half, and he's just a tank.
He's a good driver.
Yes, he loves honking the horn.
Yeah. Well, and that was a pretty good sized truck. I mean,
yeah.
Cool. So with this journey, you're you know, where you find wine and you like it and you decide this is something you're really interested in, but to become a winemaker, and even more important, to become an owner, a property owner, that's a big step. And it's a scary step. So before we talk about that exactly, what were you in your real life before that?
Oh, man. Some people would say I haven't actually lived a real life. Went to Iowa State University. I studied political science. If you ask my dad or my mom, they would say probably beer, football, and girls. So a little bit different outlooks. But I actually ended up my last two summers off from Iowa State living in a small town in Colorado called Carbondale. There's a wine shop there called the Catherine Store, and the owner, who is Rhonda Black. We got connected when I was 19 or 20. I happened to go into her wine shop with my dad, and we started talking about some of the bottles on the shelf, and the owner, Rhonda, came up and said, how old are you? I said, 20. So she said the day I turned 21, I had a job. So my last two summers off of school, I worked for her at her wine shop, and that's really what drove me to wanting to learn more about wine itself. So I started talking about harvest internships, and she and another gentleman, Steve Humble, out there, who I'd come to know, actually started reaching out to wineries in Paso, because I loved Rhone varieties, and they said, you have to try the wines from Paso. And so I tried some of the greats from around here and just was floored. So I actually ended up getting an internship at Booker Vineyard, which is immediately adjacent, in 2011.
Actually, this area is kind of interesting. It's like a little alley coming up here with all these wineries, which is fun and also makes your palms sweat as you drive. Who do I go to first?
Exactly.
Very cool. But this investment, first of all, owning a business is not for the faint at heart, and let alone a winery, because you are wearing a billion hats, which people have heard me talk about a million times: wholesale, retail, service,
all of it.
How did that come about?
Oh my gosh. At the end of my internship at Booker, Eric Jensen, owner winemaker, asked what I was doing long term, and I had no idea. I mean, I'm 23, 24 at the time. And he offered me the assistant winemaker and vineyard manager job, which I held for 6 years. So from 2011 through 2016, I was at Booker. This property came up for sale in 2012, the previous owner had offered it to Eric, and it made sense because these properties are immediately adjacent to each other. And at the time, Eric just wasn't interested in taking on any more debt or buying another vineyard. And he looked at me and said, if there's any way you can figure this out, you've got a passion, you work hard, I think you can make this work. You know what the soils do, you know what the fruit does. So I'd actually owned a farm in Iowa that I was able to sell and put a down payment on the farm out here. The land prices are a little different between Iowa
just
and California.
Yeah.
Just a little. But fortunately for me, coming out of that 2008 recession, land prices were still pretty muted here in California. So I was very fortunate with the timing.
That's very cool. The farm in Iowa, I'm just curious, were you working it as a farm, and what were you farming?
No, we had a farm, and we would rent it out
And sure, I hear that a lot.
Yeah. We rehabilitated a lot of habitat for natural wildlife when I was there. It was something that my brother, dad, and I were all passionate about, revitalizing land that wasn't used for crop and putting it in natural grasses, wetlands, trees. We just really loved seeing that transition back to its native state.
Oh, you were truly a naturalist,
yeah,
I guess.
Exactly. Yeah,
good for you. Well, you know, so many people who've gotten in this business have dirt under their fingernails, whether they work a farm or not. It just becomes part of you. And my impression talking to you is that was just inevitable, wasn't it?
Yeah, I mean, if you had asked my family while I was in college if they could envision me being a farmer or living in California, that would have been a hard no on all sides. They would have thought I would have been doing something in business, which now I am, but my brother and I kind of flip-flopped. Everybody thought he would be in the farm side of it, which I guess he technically still is, but is more on the business operation side. And I've become more of the actual hands-on farmer, which was kind of a surprising 180 for everybody, but it's one of those things that happens that way, and I wouldn't want it any other way. I love being out in the vineyard, love being outside. We're just blessed to be in the area that we're in and live here on the property too.
And this structure we're in, which is very typical of wineries in that I shouldn't say it's not typical. It's just very airy. It's very open. Lots of windows. The room we're in is wonderful for tasting and oversees the cellar itself, which I'm sure our viewers can see the tanks in the background of the catwalk. How many acres are you farming here?
So we've got 45 acres planted on our 100-acre property. The great thing about that is we're actually able to sell a majority of the fruit that we produce for the time being. We've got some great producers that buy fruit from us. Here in Paso, we've got Torin, Herman Story, Delecta, Nicora, Levo. And then in Napa, we have two brands called Tor, which is Tor Kenward, and then another gentleman named Patrice Bichon, and he owns a label called Vice Versa. So we're happy to have those guys included too.
Sure. Yeah, I know Tor. Tor's a great guy.
Yeah.
In fact, I got to get his book. I still haven't bought it yet.
Yeah.
I feel so bad. He's a wonderful guy.
Yes.
A brilliant winemaker.
Yes.
Got it. I think what's really cool and what I admire about winemakers like you is that when you're making your own wine and you're also selling your grapes too on top of it, it's a viable business thing for you, but it shows you really know what you're doing.
I mean, a couple things. I appreciate the tip of the hat, but it's predominantly about the soil. I mean, we can go days on end talking about the soil here, but really it's about our calcareous limestone and shale that we have here. There's very little water holding capacity, but the thing that the soil adds the most is a minerality and a freshness to the wine. So it allows us to keep our acid high and our pH low, so ageability is great, but every time you take a sip of the wine, it makes you salivate on your side jaw. It either makes you want to have another sip of wine or a bite of food, and it's just fantastic.
Yeah, that's its job, isn't
yes,
it?
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, perfect. What was your first vintage here?
First vintage in this facility was 2019. We actually didn't finish construction until 2020. So I was bashing heads with the GC quite often, saying, "Get out of my way! I need room to make wine," and they needed to finish up. But we finished up with construction in 2020. My wife and I actually worked with an architect out of San Antonio, Texas. His name's Brian Cordy. And for any viewers or anybody listening that will come in the future, you'll be able to see the cool architecture that we've done. It's very industrial modern. We wanted to have a ton of natural light. We are really conscious of energy consumption. So the building behind me is actually unconditioned. So all of our tanks that you can see are controlled by glycol systems. So we're able to temperature control just the tank itself versus the room, because the cubic footage in this space would just be a nightmare to heat or chill.
Yeah.
So we have a separate building for all of our cooling.
Very nice. It's a really dramatic cellar, but that's kind of a tough word to say. The tanks in a row are really impressive. I don't geek too much, but that's something I geek about, because it just gives you this impression of organization. This really nice looking and very safe looking catwalk, by the way, versus some catwalks I've been on.
Well, that was the biggest thing, is safety for us. I've been in situations at other facilities, and you've got wet feet, you're standing on top of a tank, which is stainless, and things can get a little hairy. So we wanted to make sure that two things. One, it looked beautiful, but two, it was very function over form for me. I wanted to make sure that everybody working here and also viewing, coming to taste here, was safe at all times.
We're talking about this cellar, which is a wonderful setup, and to me, again, very organized, but you have square tanks.
We do have square tanks.
Not many people have those.
The reason that we did that was when we were designing our concrete tank pad that the tanks sit on, we wanted to be able to maximize the space. So if you use a cylindrical tank versus a square tank, we actually found that we lost 17% holding capacity. So we used a company out of Canada called Lagarde, and the tanks are a little bit thicker and have channel jackets on the tank. So you can have very precise temperature control of each individual tank.
To me, they're a brilliant idea, yes, because of space and because of organization, but they also seem like you get a little bit more wine in there too.
Yeah, and that was the biggest thing for us, was just holding capacity, because if we're gonna invest the money into the concrete pad, we wanted to maximize the space that we used.
And where we're at in this upper level behind all this incredible glass, one side behind you again, as I've said, are the tanks and the cellar. On the other side, we have the vineyard. That's not too bad. It's a really comfortable space. To me, this would be an ideal space to come taste.
Oh, yeah. For now, the production facility is used as our tasting room. So when you come in, you sit with the tanks, you sit with the barrels, which is a ton of fun. But we're actually pretty far through on building permits for a tasting room. So we're going to build about a 3,000 square foot tasting room, hopefully starting in the beginning of next year.
That's great. So people can come through here and talk to the barrels
exactly.
if they like.
Yes.
Which is a good
yes,
thing, I think.
Exactly.
Do you ever talk to your barrels?
I talk to them every day.
See, that's a Bob's Burger thing.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
I had to get that in. One of the biggest concerns in the industry, other than labor, and we'll probably get to that in a minute here, is water in California.
Yep.
You're in the middle of a drought that's gone on for 7,000 years, it seems. How is it for you here in this particular area?
Water has not been a huge issue at this point. Everybody's concerned about it. Fortunately, we are very minimalist when it is in the vineyard and also in the winery. We really like to focus on stressing the vine throughout the year. Obviously, when it gets to 115 degrees 7 days in a row, like it did this year, you're putting out as much water as possible just to keep the plant alive. But because we've been withholding water from our vines for so many years, I'm not going to say that we're dry farmed, because we're not, but the vines have become adapted to not getting a ton of water. Yields are low, but that also takes away from some of the farming that we need to do on crop load for the canopy. So we really focus on more so the crop load than we do on water.
For our listeners, so they know, this will probably run toward the end of the year. We're here in October, about mid-October. So harvest-wise, where are you at? I'm getting off water for a moment here, but
yeah.
Are you finished? Or are you
still we are 100% done.
Nice.
It is October 13th, and we're pressed off, which is by far the earliest. But in late August, early September, we just went through a 14 or 16 day heat wave that was stifling.
Wow.
And it really skyrocketed sugars to the point where we've never picked in August before, but we picked in August for the first time.
Really? Well, I guess that's because of the coast for you then, I assume.
Yeah, it was just one of those things that you can't tell Mother Nature to wait.
No.
So we just followed her direction.
No, that's a very difficult thing. When it's time, it's time. How many cases are you making?
We do about 1,800 cases of reds right now and 250 cases of white wine.
And speaking of which, as I recall, I'm sorry, I'm darting all over the place.
No, it's okay.
But these are my little things that pop in my head. Grenache Blanc, not a real common wine that people make. Tell me about that.
So we do two whites that are not very common. So one being Grenache Blanc, the other one being Claret Blanche. Grenache Blanc and most Rhone varieties do so well in this area. We wanted to plant two whites side by side and kind of have a blend. But when we tasted those wines, the first vintage that we made white in 2017, we knew that they had to be borderline standalone because they were so different. The Grenache Blanc is fermented and aged in concrete tanks, and the Claret Blanche is fermented and aged in predominantly new French oak. Grenache Blanc does not go through malolactic fermentation, but what that does is it gives it a ton of brightness, freshness, and a lot of fruit characteristics, whereas the Claret goes through malolactic fermentation for rich mouthfeel, texture, a little bit bigger wine. But we did two wines separately, which are called Bamboo and Drift. But we wanted to make sure that they were almost polar opposites of each other. So they were contrasting in the sense that one wine is great for the summer and one's great for the winter, because we drink white wine all year.
Yeah, sure. Yes, I do. And for the Grenache Blanc, I don't like to put people in this position of comparing, but what would you tell our listeners it would be comparable to?
Oh, my goodness. I've never been asked that question.
I know it's tough because it's the wine is the wine.
Yeah, the wine is the wine. I can't even say Sauvignon Blanc, it's so different. But it, in the sense, it would be similar to that because of the acid and the brightness. But then the flavor profile and the density of the wine are so much different than Sauvignon Blanc. I really can't compare it to any other white wine other than Grenache Blanc.
See, because that's kind of what I was getting in my head, and that's why I went there.
Right.
I was thinking Sauvignon Blanc, but it just didn't, because there are certain Italian wines that get in the same neighborhood, but
right,
totally different finish.
Right. And I can't comment a ton on Italian wines. I drink a lot of French wines, but Italy is one of those countries to me that is very foreign.
And confusing.
Yes.
Yes. Oh my gosh, I could go on for days.
Yeah.
I think Italian winemakers are their own worst enemy when it comes to their labels
right.
and how they do things.
Yes.
But they do make some darn good
wine.
They make
some great wine.
Yeah. You live here on the vineyard as well, right?
We do. When we purchased the property, it had a triple wide on it. We still live in that house today. We've really focused all of our time and attention to the label, the winery, and our kids. So the house, we're happy to be here. You may hear my wife complain every once in a while that I can't be broken away from work, but I do live in the vines, so I think about it all the time.
Well, obviously, you're both raising these two very young kids, which makes this whole project a little more interesting.
Yes.
But her involvement in the project, is she active in other ways?
Or? Yeah, absolutely. So Becca actually went to UC Davis and studied viticulture and enology. She was the assistant winemaker here in Paso for another winery called Via Creek Cellars, owned by Chris and Joanne Cherry, for about 4 years. But then she and I were having a discussion one night where we said, if we're going to start a family, start a winery, start a brand all at the same time, we knew it was going to be all hands on deck. Yeah. And we've always been of the mindset of why dip our toe in the water? Let's just jump off the cliff head first and hope there's water down there.
Yeah.
But she does a majority of the marketing. So all the beautiful labels that you see, she does that. She runs the website, runs the wine club, but that allows her to be with our kids borderline full time, which was important for both of us.
Well, it's cool. It's a family thing. It's way early. They're just little kids. But in the back of your mind, do you hope that maybe one day they may kind of pick up the baton?
And they're so young. But yeah, in the back of your mind, you say, we want to build our vineyard, our winery for generations, whether it's our kids' generations or someone else's, we don't know. But really, we focus on being sustainable and organic in the vineyard, because giving the vines that option to live long-term is very important. We've got tons of friends over in France that have vineyards that are 70, 80, 100 years old. A vine can outlive us, which we want to make sure that we're treating the soil and our property in that way, in that manner. Because we want our vines to outlive us. We want to make sure that we're very sustainable and we're treating the earth correctly, because it's very important to us.
Sure. Well, and you've got these two kids and then a few hundred thousand.
Yes.
Yeah. Well, they really are, because it's such a big deal. I'm sure that this industry, you've had people that have had an influence on you, or just simply been the one go-to person. Is there that one person that's your mentor?
I mean, Eric Jensen, obviously, for so many years working side by side with him and learning his craft, and he was such a great teacher, is a great teacher. But there's one of the things that I fell in love with Paso is it's a community. There's tons of camaraderie in the wine industry. There's never competition. So if I pick up the phone and call a different winemaker about a key thing happening or ask questions of what they've seen, they're happy to share that information, especially with I'm going to include myself in the younger generation of winemakers and newer generation, people that are just getting started, because it's very important for the guys that have been doing it for 20 years to be able to pass on that knowledge, because I mean, rising tides lift all ships. If the guys that have been doing it at a very high level for a long time can teach the newcomers what they've learned and their mistakes and help them out, that's only going to be better for our region and for us. And so we really, really buy into that motto.
I think most people who've done things and tried to do them well enjoy sharing that knowledge because they want to maybe head off other people at the past for making horrible mistakes.
Well, and also, I mean, it feels good to be asked your opinion when you've done it at a high level for a long time. And the fact that some of these guys are open to discussing that, it's just a true show of the people in Paso and the community here, which is fantastic.
Sure. I'm sure for the time you worked for other places and you've been here, interesting, unusual, strange, weird, oddball things have happened. And I'm putting you on the spot for this one. If you might have a story of something that, you know, was just, man, I can't believe I got past that.
So in 2014 at Booker, we started trialing what we call shade cloth. And the cloth would hang over the fruit zone when we didn't have the canopy growth to be able to protect the fruit from direct sunlight. I took that a step further here at Full Draw. Our block 6 is a very steep south-faced hillside that just gets pounded with the wind. And I said, well, why don't I apply that same thought of protecting the grapes to protecting the vine? So I was taking top wire to ground shade cloth every 3 or 4 rows to help slow the wind speed down and help dehydration of the plant.
You mean like vertically?
Exactly.
Okay.
And so basically what it was doing was reducing the speed of the wind going through there. One thing I did not anticipate was the wind getting so strong that the first row in the block had every stake break and the whole row fell over. I have pictures of all the vines laying on the ground. And miraculously enough, we only lost 2 vines in that. They just kind of bent down. They had enough water in them that they didn't break. And the next day we pulled them back up and doubled the amount of stakes that we had in the ground to make sure that didn't happen again.
Oh my.
It was a very interesting one. Hey, try new things, you learn new lessons.
Yeah, and you got to try new things.
Exactly.
It's just the nature of man,
yep.
I think. This is part of the interview, which is my favorite.
Right.
And that is all the times you've done media and you've talked to people like me or people far more important than me. What's the one question you've never been asked that you would like to be asked?
You don't know what you don't know. That's a hard one. The shocking thing is about that question, anybody that comes to the tasting room, it may not necessarily be media, but it might be people tasting. They know that they may not see you again, so they ask every question. I've been asked questions of how much did the winery cost to build? And that puts you in a really uncomfortable position that you go, I don't really want to talk about that.
That's kind of personal.
Yeah. And we've been asked personal, when are you having your next kid? I'm like, I've never met you before. We're not having any more. So that kind of answers that. We were blessed enough to have a boy and a girl.
Yeah.
And we don't have to have the conversation of, if we had had 2 girls or 2 boys, should we try again? Sure. So we got very
That's lucky. A really personal question.
Yeah, I know. That's a hard one. I don't know.
Okay. Well, that's fair. I don't have to beat you over the head on that. So what's the one thing that makes you crazy about the wine business? That could be a passionate thing or that could be a negative thing.
The people. Both ends of the spectrum. Crazy, good. I mean, all the way from the restaurant side of it, with friends and people that you have working in the restaurant industry to other people in the wine industry, it's such an eclectic group of people. There's never a dull time. It's always interesting. It's always fun to watch and be a part of. Sometimes it's better to be a fly on the wall and watch versus be the person that everybody's spectating, but it happens to all of us.
Well, that does bring up one thing, and since you don't really have a true common formal tasting room, I'm always fascinated to ask a winemaker, if you meet people when they come in maybe a slightly bigger group, not a giant group, but do you ever get the chance to sort of be incognito and just to hear what people say, or do they know right away your owner?
No, I mean, being a little bit younger, it is sometimes a surprise when people come in and taste and meet me, and they look at you and go, wow, you've accomplished a lot at a young age.
You have.
And hard work and dedication, great team behind me as well. But
And no life.
Yeah. Well, predominantly that. Yes. We took our first family vacation this year in 5 years. So, yeah. But no, every once in a while, I'm very fortunate to be able to hear people commenting on the winemaker and who they might be. And yeah, every once in a while, you do hear that. And it's a lot of fun.
That's a gas.
Yeah.
Very cool.
Yeah.
Are you in restaurants at all?
We are predominantly in our area, Paso.
Sure.
We do distribution right now in Colorado, Georgia, Florida, New York. I think that's it for right now.
That's not bad.
No.
That's
and Arizona as well.
That's very cool.
Yeah.
But most importantly, for our listeners who'd like to learn about you, well, I guess for a tasting, I assume something like this would be a by appointment, correct?
Yeah, we're by appointment because we do have a small team. But the other thing about that is we want to make sure that we spend one-on-one time with each group that comes in. So when you book your appointment, we have everything set up flight style, and one person on our team will sit with you the whole time during your tasting to tell you the story, talk about all of the crazy art on the labels, and really have fun instead of being, you know, reading off tasting notes to you. It makes it very interesting and interactive as well.
Yeah, that part of it would be the fun part and the no fun part if you were reading off.
Correct,
yeah,
correct.
But importantly, for our listeners who would like to learn about you online, what is your website?
Our website is fulldrawvineyard.com. And another way you can reach out to us is through Facebook and Instagram as well. And our phone number is 805-712-4412. Feel free to reach out anytime and someone from our team will take care of you.
Very good. Connor, this has been fun spending the morning
Thank
with you
Thank you.
Here.
It's been great.
Just a great winery. Wish you nothing but success.
I appreciate it. Thank you so much.
Learn more by visiting fulldrawvineyard.com. Thanks for listening to the longest-running wine podcast online. Subscribe to the podcast at lifebetweenthevines.com or sign up to our YouTube channel. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. Life Between the Vines comes to you from Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Our host is Kay Paskoff. Our web geek is Dan Geeshan. Original music by Ray Pfister. Copyright 2022.